Welcome to the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Risa E. Lewis, Feminem Advisory Board and Fix 18 Organizing Committee. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia.
And I'm Dara Tass, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Feminem. I am usually the main host of the Feminem podcast, but today, and for actually probably the rest of the summer, I defer to Risa E. Lewis in all of her wisdom.
Thank you so much, DK Dara Tass. So, hi everyone. Dara has yet again graciously allowed me to run with an idea. I've been thinking about all the women I know. These are friends who are leaders in their field, and women who have followed their passions, women who are making a difference. Sounds special, right? Well, there actually is something really special. There's a catch. For each one of them, there's at least one unifying factor. That common factor? Emergency medicine. So in other words, each woman has had emergency medicine play a role in her current career. It could have been a chapter. It could have been a long chapter, a short chapter, or maybe just a prelude to an actual book. Today, we're going to speak with a friend who practiced clinical emergency medicine for 14 years. She actually will be one of our Fix 18 speakers.
She actually will. So our guest today is a fritter of mine, and I learned the term fritter from Ali Raja. So a fritter is somebody that you literally became friends with on Twitter. And I love that term. So Dr. Jennifer Brokaw is absolutely one of our fritters. She worked for 14 years as a board certified emergency physician before she transitioned to become a private consultant, a patient advocate, and a writer and a speaker on the topics of end of life planning, specifically around medical decision making and then also medical advocacy. It's a space that I know Jen came to at a personal calling, and I think that's one of the things we're going to talk about. But it's also a space that for any of us that have had family members who have faced those issues at the end of their life, it's something that we know is underserved in general. And the more people that focus on that in their careers, we know is better for the population at large. So Dr. Brokaw, welcome to the Feminem Podcast.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Brokaw, can you tell us a little bit about your training and experience in emergency medicine?
Yeah, I would be delighted to. I spent my training years in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then another 4 years there because my husband, who I met in medical school, had a payback to the Indian Health Service after his training in radiology. So we were there for a total of 8 years. I was lucky to get into a 3-year emergency medicine training program. I think they're a rare breed now, but they existed back then, and UNM was a 3-year program. I don't know if it is still now, but and I had a trial by fire kind of training there. I mean, New Mexico is a very impoverished state with a lot of historic poverty, actually, a lot of diversity in the racial background of people who live there. There are a lot of Asians, Latinos, and Native Americans, not too many African Americans. And it's a violent state. I mean, I don't think Breaking Bad exaggerated too much in many ways. There's a lot of gang violence in Albuquerque and unfortunately a lot of vehicular trauma on the freeways. So as terrible as that is for people who live there, it was good training in emergency medicine, and I really saw it all. When I was done with the 3-year residency program, I applied to be an NIH clinical research scholar, and I was awarded one, which was surprising. Nobody thought I would get it, but I did. I had a clinical research grant for a year to study the effects of domestic violence, or reported domestic violence, on women who present to the emergency department for any reason. And so what we did is surveyed women in the ER, whether they were there for domestic violence or not, and then brought them back at a later date for a full exam and blood work and found that, you know, the state of health of women in the emergency department was really pretty poor, whether they were victims of domestic violence or not. And the other finding that that was surprising was how many women self-reported domestic violence, whether or not they were there for it. So it reinforced the idea that all women in the ED should be screened.
So can I jump in? I'm curious, so just not for the focus of this conversation, but as a segue, what percentage of the patients did you find, just to reiterate, that were not there for domestic violence reasons, actually were victims, would report domestic violence? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it was about 25%.
Oh.
Wow.
One in four.
Note to self, remember to ask every time.
Yeah, every time. You know, we really advocated for, and I would continue to advocate for, just, you know, on your way out the door, you know, I ask all my patients if they feel safe at home or if anyone's harming them. And I just wanted to ask you too.
And not just, not just limited to women, in case we want to put that plug in as well.
Yeah. That's a good point, but especially women.
So continue us on, Jennifer.
So when my husband and I arrived in San Francisco, I took a job at San Francisco General, which is the trauma center and part of the teaching apparatus of UCSF. And that was wonderful. But I also kept up my routine of having multiple practice venues and got a job at an ER in the Castro district of San Francisco, which really served mostly gay men. And that was an amazing experience too, because it allowed me to get the experience of a niche neighborhood emergency department. And I used to joke that I was both a gay man's doctor and an ER doctor, which I never thought I would be.
So Jen, I just want to say your record is impressive, like clearly very academic, very rigorous. Plus many different emergency medicine clinical experiences. But in terms of the, you know, one of the reasons why we really wanted to speak with you today and why your story is so exciting is emergency medicine is not what you do most of your time, if any of your time, in 2018. So that's what we're going to transition a little bit and talk a little bit about that, like what caused that and when was the aha moment. And for listeners, I want to encourage you to go to Jen's website. It's Jennifer Brokaw, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R, Brokaw, B-R-O-K-A-W.com. We'll put that in the show notes as well. And you can actually read specifically about the work that she's doing now and watch some of her talks that are very inspiring and very moving and very cohesive. They give you a really good idea. So Jen, we're in San Francisco. We're at SF General. Tell us about the aha moment. When did it all take a turn?
Yeah. So in about 2007, 2008, I got itchy feet. I knew I wanted to work, but I really felt that the ED was becoming more than ever just this catchment area for all of the fails in healthcare. And in particular, I felt like the squeeze on primary care doctors was getting squeezed out into the ER. And I was seeing a lot of patients coming in with these, back when we had paper charts that were really stacked high, and they had no clue about what was going on with them or why they were there. They were just sent there by a specialist or a primary care doctor who knew they had some issue that needed to be resolved, but didn't have time to squeeze them in. And in particular, I was upset and troubled by some of the older patients that got sent to the ER, because, you know, once you get transported to an ED, it's a consent to have things done to you that you may not want done. And I participated in a couple of resuscitations that made me feel bad about what we were doing to people who were clearly near the end of their lives. without much thought to what we were doing. It's, you know, the cursory, do they have a DNR, yes or no? And if there was no tangible health directive on their chart, you know, the resuscitation began. So I started casting about looking for ways that I could get upstream and help do some case management or population management through a health plan or somewhere upstream of the ED. And I started off working at a Medicaid managed care health plan here in San Francisco called San Francisco Health Plan, which is an amazing health plan. It's publicly funded and does a very good job for the Medicaid population in San Francisco. But, you know, I learned that the role of the medical director is largely to deny care, you know, making sure that not too much money is being spent on any one person and trying to maintain a quality, government quality standard.
So not exactly what you were looking for, right?
No, I really wanted to do case management.
And use your brain.
Yeah, yeah. And in particular, you know, I think that health plans are doing this now. Case management, first of all, I learned is a nursing term. It's not considered a job for physicians, which I think is BS. But in the 70s, it was a big thing to do case management. Then it really fell out of favor. And when I was working at the health plan, they didn't really want to talk about case management. But that's clearly what, you know, our population needs, because we all know that you know, the vast amount of spending and care gets delivered to a small sliver of our population. And if we can manage that population really hands-on, we can save a ton of money. So, but that's not why I went into it, to save money. I went into it because I think the experience of care for patients, for humans and their loved ones, is not good in America, you know, when you're really sick. And it's because it's fragmented and it's at times overly aggressive and it's not coordinated. It has so much room for improvement.
But can I say something about that, actually? Because I think that there's a really key point here. And this goes back to a lot of other stuff that we kind of wrangle with in our fritter world. But if you are advocating for something that's just for the patient and also economically responsible, which is, you know, it's funny. In this case, giving responsible, compassionate care to patients at the end of their life that's also coordinated, mm-hmm. is not only humane, but it would save us a boatload of money in our system as it is, right? And that point, I feel like to gloss over that point is to minimize the value you're giving to the system, not just to the patient.
Well put, Dara, well put. I think, you know, I don't want to jump ahead here, but I'll come back to that point about the frustrations I had when I finally did jump out and create my own business doing this, and the lack of support I felt like I got from the healthcare systems and the hospitals in doing
so
it.
So the suspense, Jen, what did
you
do?
Yeah. There's
what
a
did
teaser.
You do?
There's a teaser. But so back to, you know, I went back to working in the ER after I worked as a medical director. And again, the same feelings cropped up for me. And I tell this story every time I give a talk to the lay public and sometimes to physician groups too. But, you know, I had this really poignant experience in the ER with this family. And it was just so odd that they saw me twice. But it so happened that I saw this older Chinese man in the urgent care side of the ED one day, who was tachypneic and febrile and aphasic from a stroke, and clearly had pneumonia and looked like he was going to go south. So I talked to his grown children and said, you know, I want to admit him to the hospital and he might need to go to the ICU. So I'm going to have the ICU come down. And they said, no. You know, we brought him in because he needs antibiotics, but, you know, since he had his stroke, his quality of life is so bad. He, you know, can't do anything he used to like to do. And we just want to make him comfortable, but we don't want him on a ventilator. And I you know, I agreed that that's where he was headed. So if that they didn't want that, I would make it clear to the admitting team that he was DNI and comfort measures and antibiotics were the right way to go. The daughter told me that they had lost their mother to cancer a few years before, and she had had a prolonged ICU stay. So there was a very strong feeling on all of their parts, including the man, the patient in question, that ICU was out of the question. So he got admitted. I forgot about him. And then a couple weeks later, I'm working on the trauma resuscitative side of the emergency department. And sure enough, this ambulance comes in with the medics running full speed, bagging a patient. And I recognized the guy. It was the little man. And I said, you know, where are his kids? Where is his son and daughter? And one of the medics said, well, his son's out in the waiting room. So as they were paging, the ICU team and the ER residents were running in with their succinyl choline in their back pocket. I went out and grabbed the son and said, do you remember me? I was the doctor that saw you a couple weeks ago. And he said, yes, yes. And I said, well, you told me that you didn't want your father intubated and in the ICU, and that's what's about to happen. So can you tell me what's changed? And he said, No, I don't want it, but I don't know what to do because my sister left on a business trip and I can't let my father die while she's gone. So I brought him back to the resuscitation room with me, and I had the idea to take the wall phone with the long curly Q cord and call the sister on her cell phone in China where she was doing business. And remarkably, we got a great connection. And I said, you know, this is the situation we're in. And I, you know, we need to make a decision really quickly. And she said, let me talk to my father. So we put the phone up to his ear and they chatted for about 5 minutes. And he was sort of grunting, but he started crying. And we let the conversation go on. And then suddenly he handed the phone back to me and I got on. And the woman said, I do not want my father intubated. I've said my goodbyes. I'm going to get on a plane right now and come home, but please do not intubate him. So I sent the ER residents and the ICU team out of the room, and the ER nurses and I got warm blankets and lowered the lights and pulled up a chair for the brother and son and walked out of the room, and all of us were crying. And the nurses hugged me, and I was like, oh, why can't we do this more often for people? This was such a win, you know? I mean, you know how you feel when you save a life in the ER, when a code goes well, or, you know, you save somebody from anaphylaxis or whatever, and you just feel like, wow, I just saved a life. It was that same feeling. Even though I knew the guy was going to die, I felt like I saved his death. And, you know, you save the emotional health of the survivors, which I think is such a undervalued saving the survivor's emotional health. So it was shortly after that I left EM altogether and really staked my career on this private practice called Good Medicine, which when I started it, I thought I was going to be doing a lot of patient education and second opinion and really evolved pretty quickly into an advanced care planning practice. And I would say that it did so because I was smart enough to go to a palliative care conference at Harvard early on after I opened the practice and heard this famous advanced care planning expert, Dr. Bud Hammes, talk about advanced care planning. And he developed this program in Wisconsin called Respecting Choices, and it's been really successful, and it's sort of the model for everyone else. And he really was compelling and convinced me that we could develop a program that would work, and that even people who were coming to us for what they thought were, you know, life-saving measures and second opinion and clinical trial finding for their advanced cancer could benefit from advanced care planning. And it was successful. I mean, we did over 100 advanced care plans, and they were to each one of them left the participants just agog after the process. They, you know, everybody really felt like they had an experience unlike anything they'd had before, and they felt much better about having communicated some really important things to their loved ones. And I won't give it away, but I'll tell a story when I speak at FIX this fall about a really special case of an advanced care plan and the outcome of it.
Well, I like a good suspense.
Great. So Jen, you, yeah. It's been very, I wanted to say, so, you know, in the work you're doing now with working with clients, you're translating a language, you're translating acronyms, and these are some of the acronyms that we look and see on the paperwork for our patients that come in from nursing home facilities, from rehabs, and even from homes. What can you define some of these terms and help us navigate and tell us why and who should be writing living wills?
Right. Well, you know, I am hoping that the living will just kind of rides off into the sunset soon, because it is just a really worthless document for healthcare providers. It may not be worthless to family members, but I think the number of families that have really utilized their living wills is probably, you know, very, very small. Living wills just sort of, evolved to be part of the will creation in the legal setting. And there was a recognition by trusts and estate attorneys that, you know, healthcare was a really important part of a will, and that end-of-life decisions also have financial implications for families. And so it became de rigueur for attorneys to draw up some guidelines for families about how much money should be spent and how much emotional trauma should be employed on behalf of a dying person. And people really want to, you know, in their will, they bequeath things to their loved ones, and they make arrangements for the care of their children. And so the other part of that is to make some statement about what you would want, you know, should you be at the end of your life. The problem is that it's an uncomfortable conversation. Attorneys are not interested or trained in having those conversations. So it becomes this pro forma exercise where they show you the document, you initial next to the choices you would want made on your behalf, and then you sign at the bottom, and you may say to your kid or your spouse, oh, I have the living will. I don't want anything. And then you file it away and you never see it again. And, you know, that's just really useless. And so what I hope is that we'll get to the point where we all understand that the most important decision you make about the end of your life is who is going to be speaking for you. And that's really the only legal part of the advance directive as well. So the legal part of an advance directive is the nomination of your healthcare agent, which is also known as the durable power of attorney for healthcare. And it's a really good idea to think really hard about who that person is. And most people, if they're married, pick their spouse or significant other. But when I give talks to public groups about advanced healthcare directives, I take people through a list of qualities of a healthcare agent that I think are important. And one of them is that person should be a little bit younger and in better health than you, because it's a really difficult job. And I would say that most spouses are not younger or in better health. Furthermore, they're very emotionally connected to what's happening to you and may not be in the best position to make a decision for you. And we know now that people over 65 in the hospital are a particularly vulnerable group of people. In 2014, there was an article published in JAMA Internal Medicine that showed that of people admitted to the hospital for any reason over age 65, 50% of them would have an important medical decision made on their behalf by someone else within 48 hours of admission. That's a pretty stark statistic. And it shows that, you know, that surrogate healthcare agent is a really, really important person. And actually, I don't want to digress too much.
But can I ask about bias against people being your proxy? My mother says that I cannot be her proxy because I'm a doctor and I'll pull the plug. Is there a study on that, on bias of mothers,
yes.
physicians to say that?
Well, Risa and I were just talking about that too, that, you know, you guys are a little bit younger than me and your parents are probably younger than my parents, but there is a shift that happens, you know, in your relationship with your parents. And whereas, you know, I think that my dad in particular was a little reticent to have me running the show for him medically, he's becoming more and more amenable. And yeah, because they get older and they're less able to process all the information they need to process. And suddenly your medical degree becomes very valuable to them.
Dara, I was going to say thank you for actually introducing one of the topics I just wanted to cover. I posed this to Jen. I said, what do you do when you have parents that sort of say to you what your mom said to you? Because full disclosure, my parents have sort of said the same to me. And it's ironic. Like, we're the only ones with MDs in the family, yet they are not so sure they want us to be those advocates. So the question for Jen is, should we be hiring advocates? Should we be the advocates? You know, what would you recommend for people to do?
That's a great question. You know, I do think that a great healthcare agent to name is somebody with a healthcare degree. So in my own case, I have my husband as my number one decision maker right now. But my number two is a close friend who's an internal medicine doctor. And I think that is such a valuable, valuable thing to have, because you know the vocabulary, you're not intimidated by other doctors. And those are important qualities of a healthcare agent, to be able to stand up to the medical team and ask hard questions and hold them accountable to what the patient's goals and wishes are, and ask the question, how is this going to get us to where we want to be, which is getting the person home? Or every decision along the way is important. And I think that most lay people don't understand that, you know, getting the pacemaker put in may prolong somebody's life that they never wanted prolonged in the first place. They just think, oh, they need a pacemaker? Okay, we'll say yes to the pacemaker.
So it's funny. So I actually, to segue this into the idea of how this turned into a career, an alternative career for you, right? Anybody out there? Because I've done, so three times in the past 48 hours, I've acted as a medical advocate for a family or friend who needed somebody to translate, like we're talking about medical translator. And every one of them thinks I'm doing the hugest favor for them. And I'm like, actually, I find this to be my duty as a, you know, a trained physician in our community. This is the thing I think is really important. How do you turn that into a business? And as somebody who gives it away for free a lot, but knows that would be a really good skill set that I have. I'm not changing jobs just yet again. No, Dr. Mills, don't worry. But I am curious, how do you get people? Like, is it really just client services? How do you convince people that what you're doing to them is valuable? Do you feel like there needs to be like a community aspect to it too? Because it's only people that can afford your services.
Right.
Like, I mean, in that space, I wonder, like, how do you structure that part of this job?
I think that question remains to be answered, because I had good medicine for about 6 years. And, you know, economically, it wasn't such a great decision. I mean, that's why we all ended up splintering off and doing our own things, because it is hard to get people to pay you to do this. And it's hard to charge people at a time when they're really vulnerable and have a lot of other medical bills. But the value of the service is so tremendous. I never had people complain about our charges. it's just, you know, I think a lot of people decided not to hire us ultimately when they saw how much it was going to cost them. But, you know, I think women do this more than men, nurses and doctors, pro bono. And I really think that women should think about charging for their services in general more and not being apologetic about it. When I first started Good Medicine, I really did a lot of hand-wringing about charging people these concierge prices, because I always worked in public ERs and I have such a public-minded mindset. I just felt really awkward about it. And this really high power attorney who's a friend of mine who charges $1,000 an hour said, get over it. You know, if you're worth it, they'll pay you and they should pay you. And I really think women are
women don't ask
good at that. Yeah, they don't ask. They undervalue themselves. And it would be good for us to start charging people for all the good we do in the world. I mean, you know, think about the family caregivers out there, most of whom are women. I mean, you know, there are some estimates that there are like billions of dollars of our economy are being supported by unpaid family caregivers who are women. So at some point, we all have to be the agents of change and charge them. Get a QuickBooks account, get a separate little business. You can be a sole proprietor and you could have Derek Cass Consulting. And if they're not, you know, a family member or your really close friend, but they're a friend of a friend, send them an invoice. I dare you.
Michael Cassley, very happy with Derek Cass Consulting, LLC.
I think this seems like an appropriate time to quote a Latin phrase, dux femina facti, a woman led the expedition. Jen, this has been a very, very rich discussion, very inspiring conversation, an excellent teaser for your Fix 18 talk. Can you just give us a final point that you'd like to leave the audience regarding our summer series topic, that being a chapter in my story, emergency medicine?
Yeah, I think training in emergency medicine is the best decision any doctor can make. You know, especially for women in medicine, it is assertiveness training 101. I mean, the first time you have to call a surgeon on the phone, get them out of bed in the middle of the night to come see a patient that you think may need to go to the OR, you learn how to be an assertive woman. You also learn how to prioritize and see the forest for the trees. And I think time and again in my patient advocacy practice, I had people come to me with a laundry list of problems. And it was through my EM training that I was able to really focus in on what the most important problem was for them. And it was like the light bulb went off above their head. Nobody had really been able to do that for them before. And finally, I think that, you know, EM is an advocacy specialty. EM takes anyone who walks in through the door and treats them all the same way. And so it gives you a mindset about being an advocate for patients that few other doctors have.
Feminem, Risa Lewis, Dara Cass, 110% agree. So great. Dara, before we sign off, any announcements?
Yeah, I think I do actually have some announcements, other than the fact that it is really hot in New York today. So very hot. So we actually have, we just opened tickets for the Revive Conference. Dr. Lewis, have you heard of the Revive Conference?
I haven't. Can you tell me a bit about it?
I can, actually. So after last year's huge success at the Fix Conference, with our workshops and didactics, we actually decided to split them up. So the didactic conference is Fix 18, where you will see speakers such as Dr. Jennifer Brokaw. But since it was kind of so full of very cool and exciting energy, we decided to hold off on adding those workshops and run it as a separate educational development retreat for women. So it is limited to 100 attending physicians who are women. Okay, not everybody has to be in emergency medicine, but we're starting this pilot, this conference, for only women attendings. We are limiting it to 100 tickets because we want to have it be intimate, and the faculty of this particular conference is extraordinary. We do have some notable women physicians speaking and leading workshops. So, for example, Dr. Tracy Sanson, Dr. Diane Birnbaumer, who are well known to the feminine community, obviously. We also have other emergency medicine physicians like Dr. Ellen Weber, who's teaching about how to get accepted how to get your paper accepted in a journal. Dr. Ann Futterman is actually a psychologist who's going to speak to a lot of the narrative medicine and interpersonal aspects of being a woman physician. And we have a psychiatrist, we have multiple leaders in community medicine, we have a financial planner. It's an amazing workshop. We have a woman who teaches women how to run for office, holding a workshop on getting political, whether you choose to run for office or not, and have a start a nonprofit. So it's really extraordinary. So tickets are on sale now. There are only 100. Get them while they can. Any questions, you can always reach out to us. And if you are interested in being a sponsor, we always have those options available as well. That's it for now.
Great. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye.